September 5th in an interview with Robert Cabot. I'd just love to hear a little bit about your background and what led you to founding Linnea.
Oh, God.
Is that a big question?
Yes.
Sorry.
I have no idea what the answer is.
Well, are you Canadian originally?
No.
No.
No, I was born in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived for a long time in Italy. Somewhat in rebellion during the Vietnam War and after 10 years of working in the U.S. government for foreign aid programs, I was fed up with what we were doing in the world, what our image was in the world. So I lived in Italy for 20 years and then decided that it might make more sense to come back and see a different side of this part of the world. And communities were particularly interesting to me. In the abstract, I hadn't experienced them until coming back in 1976, 20 years ago. And at that point, my wife and I and her small child we bought a camper and we traveled around from commune to commune for 2 years.
Oh, how interesting.
It was very interesting.
Mainly in the United States?
Yeah, some in Canada, but most in the United States. Some in England too, but
mm-hmm.
not in the camper. We visited Pinhorn and two or three other communities in England. But it was mostly in the States. And they were most of the ones that you probably still know about. The Alpha Farm
mm-hmm.
and The Farm. And,
mm-hmm.
and
Twin Oaks?
Twin Oaks, we never got to Twin Oaks. We intended to, but we're kind of put off by the Skinner philosophy.
Okay.
It seemed a little mechanistic. So we never bothered with Twin Oaks. And, just a whole bunch of others. We probably visited at least 20, 30 countries.
Wow. Was there any one in particular that you liked the most or maybe thought of joining?
Well, we were looking at them all from the point of view of possibly joining them. I guess not, really. They were all interesting, but we did get quite interested in a community in Canada called the Texas Lake. What was it called? Texas Lake Community. But it was beginning to fold. They were being evicted. And in the meantime, we had driven up to Cortez Island, British Columbia, too, just to see it. We heard about it, wanted to visit it, and in so doing, came across this property on the lake, on Cortez Island, which immediately spoke to us so strongly that we said, well, I guess maybe we're supposed to start a community of our own. And in fact, what we did was we started it together with some of the remnants, or the leaders, if you will, of the Texas Lake group. So there were really four of us who were the founders of the Linnea, although others came in very quickly, or almost at the same time, but kind of at our invitation rather than the other way around. And we began to model ourselves somewhat after Findhorn, with an idea of arriving at consensus through meditation, or listening to our inner voice or our higher self or whatever words you want to put on it. So, and that worked very well for us for several years.
Did you ever visit Sirius Community?
No, it was just being started about the same time.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I think it was a little later than we were. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, though. By then, we'd already fixed on the West Coast. And so we never got around to visiting Sirius.
Sounds like you might have been similar mm-hmm. in some ways. Mm-hmm.
There was another Fin Duan community, a sort of spin-off Fin Duan community in southern Oregon.
Oh.
And I'm not sure whether it ever came about, but it was similar to Sirius. They had some land figured out, but I never followed up on it. Mm-hmm. So Fin Duan was, in fact, a kind of inspiration for a number mm-hmm. of us.
How did you get the name Linnea?
Well, Linnea, you know what Linnea is?
No, I don't. It's
a plant. It's circumpolar, grows everywhere in temperate zones, and it's very hardy and small and clings to the earth and has a twin flower. In fact, it's often called a twin flower. It's sort of a almost a brown vine, and it just seemed appropriate as a symbol.
I'm not even sure if I spelled it right. How do you spell it?
Linnaea.
Aea.
It was the plant. You know who Linnaeus was?
I'm not sure.
He was the science, the botanist in the 17th century, I guess. Russian, who classified plants.
Oh.
He started the whole Latin name classification of plants. Mm-hmm. And he had been urged all his life to name a plant after him. He's still the source of the classification of botanical classifications. But on his deathbed, he finally succumbed to people urging him, and he named this little plant after himself as his favorite plant.
That's Linnea. Great.
Linnea.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this an income-sharing community?
Yes and no. We didn't ask anyone to take a sort of poverty vow or to cough up all their mm-hmm. inheritance or whatever. But on the other hand, we all work together and share whatever we can bring into the community on a kind of day-to-day basis.
What sort of work did people do?
It was an old homesteaded farm, 320 acres on the lake, and it had a raw milk dairy herd when we took it over, and a couple of wonderful vegetable gardens and quite a number of fruit trees and a lot of wooded areas. So we ran the raw milk dairy and we raised veggies and sold them. And we also ran for two or three years a program for the Canadian youth training program. Called Katimovic. So we had 20, 25, sort of late teenage Canadians working with us and supposedly learning a different lifestyle.
And they actually lived there?
Slept
with you? Wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Besides the teenagers, how many people actually were part of the community?
It varied, of course, like all communities, but it probably averaged about 20, including a scattering of children.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there just a big farmhouse, or did you have other buildings as well?
There were a number of buildings, a couple of barns, and one main farmhouse, and a big Quonset hut that had been used for summer camp by the former owner, which we used for this itinerary program. And then we built a lot of small dwellings. We built a little hut, sort of, out of a pigsty, for instance, mm-hmm. and another one out of a wash house, which my wife and I lived in, but we kind of rebuilt, fixed them, moved them around. We had a number, and then there was a chicken coop that was turned into another house, and a powerhouse where there used to be an electric generator was another person's little dwelling. So, but we mostly cooked and ate communally. Although as families began to develop into nuclear families as well, then there was a certain amount of home cooking as well.
Did you follow any particular diet?
I guess really all of us were vegetarians most of the time. And we ate a lot of what we produced. A lot of what we ate was what we produced, to put it more accurately.
Okay.
Of course, all the dairy products and the veggies, and we dried a lot of vegetables and preserved a lot of fruit and so on.
How did you handle chores?
How did we handle what?
Chores, work sharing.
Let's see. People just kind of fell into whatever the event was.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever needed to be done, got done. There was seemed to be no problem in that. We would eat communally and, of course, discuss what had to be done. And somebody would always come forward and say, well, yeah, that's a medium. There wasn't a sort of roster or, and it wasn't, at least it wasn't supposed to be authoritarian at all. In fact, we prided ourselves in being a leaderless community.
Uh-huh.
And we did quite a lot of, other people, not myself particularly, but other people did quite a lot of talking about that around on the commune circuits.
Mm-hmm.
As we visited each other, we would talk about how we were a leaderless community.
Mm-hmm. Were your members mainly Canadian, or were they Americans?
Half and half.
Mm-hmm. Were the Americans, did they tend to be people who were disillusioned with what was going on in the States, and that's why they were there?
Yeah, well, several of them were escapees from the Vietnam War. Some were sort of back to the landers who kind of ended up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
There were several of these Atimova kids ended up returning and staying and being a part of our community.
Well,
It was a mix, I would say. Mounted some. There were the freeloaders too. Freeloaders became quite a problem. How do you deal with freeloaders? People who really didn't volunteer to do anything, they had their own hang-ups about one thing or the other. And actually, toward the end of our tenure there, we found ourselves becoming very, I think, overly restricted on who we would consider as a member of our community. Because we've been kind of burned several times by having a completely open door policy. We ended up with some undesirables, if you will.
Did you have any sort of formal membership process?
At least we tried to formalize it several times. We had probably, on average, we had a sort of policy of a waiting period, of a trial period of several months. And then a sort of, I guess, really always informal kind of feeling of, okay, you're a member, or a sort of general push to say you really aren't a member.
Ah,
But that was always difficult, to say you're not a member.
Right.
It was a tough one.
Would you actually take a vote on members?
Well, since we were trying to run, and we're running by consensus, voting really wasn't what it was at, where we were at. We would tune in meditation. And didn't have too much trouble coming up with a consensus on almost every issue, including membership issues. Although I guess I would add that consensus tended, in the case of, in perhaps in every case, consensus tends to slow things down an awful lot. So you tend to say no more easily than say yes through consensus. And the result is that you tend to get less done than you would by some kind of a voting process or an authoritarian process. And this is very frustrating for a lot of people. A lot of us were frustrated by it, but stuck to it and believed in it.
Do you think the benefits outweigh the drawbacks?
Yeah.
Now, I know you said you were trying to be somewhat like Fintorn in your spirituality, I guess. Would you say that, or maybe you've already done this, but I was just wondering if you could sort of articulate for me the ideology or vision of the group?
I guess maybe I have already done it.
Yeah.
There was no sort of religious requirement or bent. I would say we were largely non-Christian, and I think the tendencies were somewhat towards Buddhism and somewhat toward North American indigenous people's practices. But the sort of main factor in our spirituality, if you will, was to conduct ourselves through consensus and arriving at consensus by what we call tuning in. Is that?
Yeah, that's good.
Is that a term?
Well, I've heard of attunement before.
Yeah,
okay. In fact, I just went to a place called Sunrise Ranch in Colorado, where they do attunement. I don't know if you're familiar with it. They're the emissaries.
Right,
emissaries of divine light.
Yeah, I know several emissaries.
Okay. Yeah, there's one in BC, 100 Mile House.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did you get along with your neighbors or the surrounding community? Or were you too rural to have neighbors?
We were pretty rural, but we had a lot of neighbors.
Okay.
We were kind of notorious. I mean, mm-hmm. This is an island of, in those days, about 700 population. And the population was made up of about probably two-thirds of folks who've been there for a couple of generations, logging, fishing, sort of minor farming. People who some would characterize as rednecks. And the other third would be made up of people escaping from urban life, or the Vietnam War, or one thing or another, or maybe escaping from themselves. So there was quite a duality, quite a contrast between these two populations. And we, needless to say, fitted into this second category much better than the first category. But I think we were always a little bit the laughing stock of the rednecks, if you will. But on the other hand, we ended up being, I think, respected partly because we worked so hard, and we supplied the whole island with raw milk and a lot of vegetables, and that people respected and realized how much work that was. And we were ended up being represented on the governing board of the island. I was the vice president of the Ratepayers Association. Ratepayers Associations in that part of Canada are the same as city council, town council, whatever. And one of our members now, more recently, who's still living up there, became the only elected official from the island, representing the island on a BC-wide board, governing board. So, I think ultimately we gained respect and friendship from most of the rednecks.
Now, were there children there?
Was it what?
Were there children? I know you had the teenagers, but did the community members have kids?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you homeschool them or have your own school or anything like that?
Well, there is a public school on the island. And in the first years, that's what our kids went to. But we had always, from the beginning, hoped to start some kind of an alternative school. And almost did. We were there for 5 years. I was there for 5 years. And toward the end of those 5 years, we'd almost started a Waldorf school, a Brooklyn Old Snyder school. Mm-hmm. But it didn't quite come together before we left. Now that Linnea is running not a Snyder school, but it is a private school, very, very successfully. They had, I think, a somewhat larger enrollment than the public school, much to the consternation of the people who are running the public school.
Sure.
It's a very successful little school.
So the community still exists?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
No, it still exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing very well. How it governs itself, though, I don't know. I really don't know. I suspect they use less attunement, but I'm not sure of that. And at least one or two of the people there were there with us right almost from the very beginning. So it's been a continuity over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And why did you end up leaving?
Well, there were several reasons. My wife and I began to get involved in a lot of other projects around the globe. charitable projects, philanthropic projects. And it was very hard to do that from Cortez Island. Just traveling was difficult. It took about 24 hours to get to an international airport.
Yeah.
So that was one reason. Probably the key reason really was, as I said, we had considered ourselves a leaderless community. And I think we really all believed it. And then one day, toward the end of our 5 years there, in one of our interminable meetings, and that's one of the problems, incidentally, with communal living and with communal living by consensus, that you spend about half your waking hours in meetings.
Right.
And in one of those meetings, one of my wife's very best friends suddenly came out of meditation and said, somewhat angrily, she said, "You know, I just realized after all these years that we're not a legalist community at all. That you, Penny, my wife's name, and Robert, are really our leaders." And I guess she didn't say it, but the implication was that she resented it. And that came as a pretty severe blow to both of us. She was my wife's particularly good friend, and it seemed like a kind of betrayal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, to give this woman her due, she was coming from an attunement and was just saying what she found in that attunement. So it didn't upset me so much as on the personal basis, but more on the basis of sort of, gosh, I guess she's right. And being right meant that we had been doing something wrong, that I had been doing something wrong, that I had not assumed the role in a public and obvious way, that evidently I'd been playing in a secret way, at least in some people's opinion, in fact, including my own. As I look back on it, I realize that, yes, I suppose the buck did stop with me more than with anyone else. And so then we said, well, what do we do about this? And it seemed that either we'd have to start all over again and say, yes, this is a leadered authoritarian community with leaders. We hope they're benign dictators, but nevertheless, they're there. And see what would happen. The likelihood being that most people would have left, because they really liked the idea of leaderlessness and would have wanted to continue. Or the alternative being that we leave. And we chose the latter. We chose to leave. Now, there were other reasons too. Community, we were raising a young family. We had, by then, about a 9-year-old. And then we had a child that was just born on the island about a year before. And my wife was pregnant with our third child. And we began to realize that we were not giving enough time to our family, that the demands of communal living were just so overwhelming that instead of having a bunch of parents, our 9-year-old, for instance, really had no parents. We like to think of it as being, he's got all of these wonderful people around to parent him, but the opposite was almost true. That is, really, none of us were adequately full-time parents for him. And we were afraid that would happen with our younger ones. And so I guess we were burned out. And I would say still, I think, as a generalization, I think communal living is the right way for all of us to live in theory, but in practice I don't think we have evolved far enough to carry it off successfully in most cases. There are, of course, many exceptions to that. And I think most of the exceptions have managed by making concessions, by making compromises, fairly serious compromises, and by tolerating a high turnover. Which I think you'll find is true with most of the so-called established communities, is a pretty heavy turnover.
Were there any rules at Linnea as far as conduct goes, for example, like regarding things like maybe drug use or smoking, alcohol, sexual behavior, things like that?
No, we were pretty straight, I would say, pretty straight. Mm-hmm. There was a certain amount of pop around, but it was done very privately. And trying to think of tobacco, I suppose they probably wanted to be able to smoke. And I don't think there was any heavy-duty drugs. And the sexual mores were pretty straight.
So, would you have described yourself at that time at all as being a hippie or a counterculture or any of those terms?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Counterculture. I mean, hippie was a by then a fairly worn out term.
Okay.
But other people certainly would have described us as hippies.
Mm-hmm. What did you like the best about living in community?
I guess it kept my consciousness level high. Conscious living, conscious in everything that we did. And that, of course, includes not only interpersonal relationships and spiritual practices, but also environmental. Such as frugality and care for the planet. One of the things we were doing up there, another activity, was to conduct a small charitable foundation. And we worked it, again through consensus, several of our members formed a little group. And we even had an executive director who was Betty Ditko.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And through consensus, we were able to direct a certain amount of money to other communities to help them acquire land and put that land in a trust.
Mm-hmm.
So land trust was one of our big things.
Now is Linnea a land trust?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a land trust, and within the Linnea property, there are two areas that have been set up as a totally hands-off wilderness areas, wilderness reserves. And Linnea operates under pretty heavy-duty covenants and restrictions. And if they violate those restrictions, they lose the stewardship of the land. Although there's a certain amount of legal dispute going on right now about that, which is kind of sad. Maybe I shouldn't go into that. It's, okay. It is very complicated.
Okay. It seems like I've actually heard about a lot of communities where they've had problems with lawsuits, people wanting to get equity out of the land or something like that.
Well, it's a little that, but, you know, there's always been a problem of where we put all this time into building our own little house, who owns the house?
Right.
And I think we've successfully, even now, 10 years after we left, they still hang on to the principle that no, there's no private ownership within the property. The argument right now is it hasn't to do with private ownership within Linnea. It has to do with whether the actual legal ownership, which is the Turtle Island Risk Stewards Society, it's a charter society, whether it can turn around and charge the Linnaeans rent.
Oh.
Or whether, in fact, it could turn around and actually sell Linnea out from under the stewards. In other words, in both cases, whether they could violate the land trust that we set up. And this is an argument for lawyers to deal with that is fairly difficult. Now, Linnea also had an argument with the British Columbia government as to whether they were tax exempt. And for a while they were being charged very heavy taxes as if they were a resort or something. But they recently won their case in the BC Supreme Court, which held them to be, yes, in fact, a very charitable society that need not pay anything other than a sort of nominal property tax. Put them in the same category as a church or a school.
Now, before I asked you about the best part, what was the worst part for you of living in community?
Well, I said some of taking us away from our children. The meetings got to be boring. Boring. I mean, tiring. I guess the word tiring. Just it's hard. It's very, very hard work to conduct yourself on a high consciousness level and through consensus. It's just hard.
Yeah.
Also, let's see. Well, my wife and I were mostly responsible for running the dairy. And that's very hard work.
Yeah.
It's very demanding. The cows don't give you a holiday.
Right.
So you're there all the time.
And your hours are really hard.
The hours
too.
Are horrible. Mm-hmm. It's almost always dark when you're milking the cows,
right.
And so forth. So that was another part of just hard work. And I guess another problem really was this membership problem and how to deal with the people who really weren't appropriate to be there. Was hard to do.
Did you end up having to kick some people off?
Yeah, and that was not easy, was not pleasant for the kickers or the kickies.
Would you describe Linnea as a success?
Yes, I would. I think on a sort of material plane, yes, it's a real success. It's got a good school going. It's got instead of this Canada Youth Program, it has a series of apprenticeship programs for gardening and for orchard work and for dairy farming and appropriate technology things, and permaculture. It has several areas of real success. It's also really deeply accepted now by the local community, and really a part of the local community. They also have a part of their vegetable garden. One vegetable garden is made available to anybody in the island who wants to come in and garden there and share the produce and so forth. So over the years, I think they've gained real respect and love, the islanders, the fellow islanders. What its spiritual practice is now, I just don't know. Whether that's a success or not, I don't know.
Are there things that you learned during your time at Linnea that you have carried forward into your life today?
I would say attunement. I guess respect for that way of life, which before experiencing it was just a theoretical respect. Now I have a deep, burned-in respect for it, and for the people who were able to do it, keep on doing it.
It's somewhat unusual for a community to have lasted as long as Linnea has. Any feelings for what's kept it going over the years?
Well, let's see. I think that the original philosophy of consensus and attunement was a very firm foundation. And even if it isn't practiced now, and as I say, I don't know, I think still the foundation is there. The land, position of the land is superb. It's an absolutely wonderful piece of land. It's rich, and varied, and beautiful. It's just an incredible place for community. And it was land that was made available to Linnea without any cost. It was given to
her. Oh, my. Yeah. I didn't realize that. So you've had a benefactor?
I had a benefactor. Mm-hmm. And that made a lot of difference.
Yes.
So the people didn't have to scrounge to pay off mortgages and so forth, and could get a very wonderful piece of land rather than having to settle for a less wonderful piece of land. There's no benefactor now, but the kickoff was I think very important to get that, to get it going. Helped a lot. I guess those are the major factors in why it's a success.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of along the same lines, as a final question, if a group were to get together to start an intentional community, what advice would you offer them?
I'm not sure these are in the right order. It sounds like some of them.
Okay. Shall I ask you that again?
Yeah, ask it again.
If a group were to to get together to form an intentional community, mm-hmm. what advice would you offer them?
Okay, well, I would say to have a some kind of spiritual affinity.
Mm-hmm.
Would be one. I think another is to do everything possible. In fact, maybe it's a sine qua non that the place where they are be removed from the commodity market, from any financial encumbrance, from any sense of personal property. In other words, that it be put into some form of land trust. I guess those are the two basic ones that I come up with.
Do you think consensus is an essential reading?
Well, I think I don't know. I would certainly hope that consensus would be chosen. But I think there are a good many communities around who don't use consensus who are successful. At least when I knew something about it. I'm out of touch.